You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
Welcome, everyone. It's so good to be up here. I'm on a, I was on a 3-week sabbatical. I just want to right now, everyone probably feels like, man, what's he coming back with? Just lower the expectations right now. Let's just turn the knob down on the pressure I might feel. So here I am back in the saddle again here at Life in Deep Ellum, and I'm super grateful. I just want to say thank you to our board who make sabbaticals available to me, Rachel, and our staff. And for Rachel and me, this is it's not only protect us from the dreaded burnout, refreshing us. It's not just about re-energizing. It's about reorienting. So if I do this sabbatical thing right, I come back more in alignment with what God is asking me to do. Or maybe to be more specific, who God is asking me to be. You guys notice the difference, the small difference between that? I once had a therapist tell me to stop asking, what do I want to do? She told me, start asking this question, who do I want to be? So why don't you repeat that question with me? Who do I want to be? It's a good question. One of the trips I was able to make during my sabbatical was to Big Bend National Park. How many have been to Big Bend? It is, I mean, I highly recommend it. It was like another planet. It's amazing. One of our board members, Janice, sent me this huge long email with all these things that you have to do these things. Don't miss these things. So I basically just did what she said. And one morning, Will Ritchie went with me on the trip, and I drove down to see the sunrise at Santa Elena Canyon. And as we approached, the horizon was filled with these mountainous cliffs. And we're getting down there, and I'm like, dude, it's the cliffs of Mordor. And Will was like, what's that? And I was like, man, you totally need to watch more fantasy. What are the cliffs of Mordor? Where are they from? All right, there are all my nerds. Bring them in. And I was grateful to have Will with me on the trip. Will and I actually, at one day, we got across at a portal that goes over to a small Mexican town. We crossed the Rio Grande. It was legal. And we paid a guy, literally paid a guy, $5 to row us across the Rio Grande in a rowboat with oars. That happened. We get over there, and it's about, I don't know, 3/4 mile to the little village. And they say, you can hop in the back of a truck, and we'll drive over there for $8. And I'm like, no, thank you. Or you can pay $5 for a donkey or $8 for a horse. I was like, huh. I turned to Will. I was like, horse or donkey, bro? And without a pause, he lifts his hand to the sky, and he's like, donkeys, bro! And that's what happened. We rode into Boquillas on a donkey. So when Will and I followed Janice's advice to go down to Santa Elena Canyon to see the sunrise, we were not disappointed. Yeah, it's amazing. It's such a beautiful place. A couple days in, Trey Miles actually joined us for a couple days, and we got to do some hiking. And following some more of Janice's advice, we drove about an hour and a half north to McDonald Observatory for what they call a star party. It was the highlight of my sabbatical, doing this star party. It sounds like a hidden level on like some sci-fi RPG. Star party, right? And we went to the star party. And we're all sitting out, freezing, under these skies. Just the big, huge, beautiful skies. No light pollution. And there is a scientist who has, kind of his voice is being amplified. And he has this hyper focused like flashlight laser thing, and he's pointing at stars, and you can see the beam, and he's drawing constellations. And I learned more about the sky in 30 minutes than 39 years of my whole life. It was just the most amazing experience. And all of a sudden, I just felt connected. You know what I mean by that? I just felt connected. These huge skies that my ancestors were looking at long before the Industrial Revolution, long before the scientific revolution, heck, long before the wheel was invented, these skies are what people sat under. And I don't know what it was, but I just felt small. Like it just made me shrink down probably into my appropriate size. And I felt utterly insignificant in this great, wide, mysterious universe, which is the opposite of what our modern culture is trying to do. We're trying to feel big all the time, and yet we're all disconnected. But by feeling small and connected, it felt like I was breathing the kind of life God always wanted for me. Does that make sense? So when I got back from sabbatical, I was told about the series that we've been on in The Good Life. I listened to Rachel's sermon on podcast, and I told her it was amazing. It was fantastic. I didn't get to hear Mimo's sermon, but I've heard really, really good things from people who from his sermon. And so aren't we fortunate to have so many good like speakers, teachers? Yeah, it's just awesome. We're fortunate. So Rachel gave an introduction to The Good Life. Mimo talked about expectations the next week, and then Rachel talked about identity. And I've been told that my assignment is to talk about values. Values of the good life. Now, thankfully, this series is based on one of my most favorite books. Everyone should know my favorite book of all time is definitely written by C.S. Lewis, The Great Divorce. When I read it in college, it just kind of like opened the door to the possibility of creativity being involved in the way that we think about God and theology. But if I'm to be honest about where I kind of currently stand today in terms of my theological framework, there are three books. I'm going to tell you my top three right now. They'll change over time. But number three was Adam's Return. This is a book by Franciscan priest Richard Rohr. A guy named David Cole in our faith community gave this to me about 5 years ago. I mean, it just totally kind of wrecked me. And it was this beautiful picture on just the process of salvation and how God works in our lives through rituals. Number two, Failure of Nerve. This isn't even a Christian book. This book was recommended to me by my therapist. It's written by a Jewish psychologist. I read it about 5 years ago. And the subtitle is Leadership in the Age of the Quick Fix. So it helped me think about all the different things that our culture does to create anxiety, whether down from the family all the way up to the top levels of the government. And then number one, my number one book is Desiring the Kingdom by James K.A. Smith, in which this whole series is based on, The Good Life. I read about 7 years ago. It was given to me by another guy who's moved on, but he was in our faith community for a while, a guy named Brian Dugan. Some of you remember him. And I have no qualms with admitting that it helped me lay the foundation for how I think about discipleship, spiritual formation, what it means to be human. If you're interested in reading it, it's super heady, has a lot of philosophy in it, and he wrote kind of a more accessible version of it, and I would encourage you to read that. Instead, it's called You Are What You Love. And I'm going to give you the quick cliff notes. Can I give you the gist real quick? And so some of you can be like, oh, I don't need to read it now. So here it is. Western society as a whole has approached education, basically all understanding of training, mentorship, and even parenting with the ideas of French philosopher René Descartes, the one that famously said, I think, therefore, I am. This has led to what I personally call the humans as boxes idea. So basically, we are humans, we are empty containers, and all we need to do is pour information into us in order to shape and form us. We do this in schools, we do this in training seminars and conferences, we do this in churches. The problem is that the Enlightenment got it wrong. Fundamentally, information by itself does not transform us. It has purpose, but it doesn't transform us. James K.A. Smith lays out a compelling argument that we are not fundamentally thinking beings, that we are desiring beings. Our beliefs don't shape us, our thinking, our loves do, our affections shape us. So I am not what I think or believe deep down. I am what I love. I am what I worship. No matter what religion I claim to be devoted to, if you look at my life and the liturgies of love, that's truly who I am. So I call this a human as heart's idea. What we love is what shapes us. This is why at Life in Deep Elm, we tend to downplay beliefs and doctrine. Not that we don't think it's important. It has a role to play. But we think it's way more important to have liturgies, practices that we do daily and that have dramatic consequences on the transformation of our lives over time. We believe that's way more important. James K. A. Smith uses daily examples of consumerism that we all engage in, whether we know it or not. He talked about worshiping at the mall, which is kind of his way. I know malls are like, not everyone goes to malls anymore, but like it's his way of talking about consumerism, how consumerism is super, is basically a religion in our country. Marketers don't care about tapping into what we believe. They tap into what we desire. And over time, our interactions with these messages shape us. And whether we recognize it's happening or not, many of us over time begin to believe, I am what I buy. My possessions define me. My purchases say something very important about who I am. In other words, consumerism offers daily liturgies that lead me straight into idolatry. Yay, right? Yay for idols. And don't get me started on, this James K. Smith talks about the liturgies of how we incorporate nationalism or patriotism. He points out everything from subtle propaganda from the National Treasure movies, which are really fun, to the liturgies that happen before an NFL football game. And guys, he wrote this a decade ago. This is long before the drama of this year. James K. Smith is not an alarmist. In fact, he's a very conservative-leaning kind of Calvinist. Like his thinking is Calvinism. And I don't agree with those theological approaches, but his observations are brilliant. They're brilliant. He is merely saying that what we do, our regular practices, shape our hearts. They shape what we worship. And our culture, by its very nature, is going to try and persuade us to live by its values. That's just what it's going to do. And those values rarely, if ever, align with God's values. So no matter what I say I believe, if I am daily practicing the liturgies of my culture, I will inevitably, in places in my heart, be led towards idols, idolatry. You know, we read the Bible and we think of little wooden stone statues. But in our modern culture, those have turned into isms. Isms. Now, I'm sorry to get so heavy. So quickly, I have been on sabbatical for 3 weeks, so I have a lot to say. So turn to your neighbor in your most exasperating tone, say, I guess we should just listen to what he has to say. Yeah. Yeah. How about we read some Bible? All right, Luke 19. Turn to Luke 19. What I want to do is to use this parable that Jesus teaches as a way of commenting on kingdom values. Like, what does God truly care about? This isn't to say that, like, the things that don't make the list that God cares about are evil. That's not the point. We don't live in a very simplistic black and white world. It is a spectrum, but I think it is very important for us to be able to identify the things that we clearly know God cares about. And I want to use this this parable in Luke 19 to kind of just talk about that. All right, the parable of the 10 minas, or minas, however you want to pronounce it. I don't really know which is right. Verse 11, while they were listening to this, he, that is Jesus, went on to tell them a parable. Because he was near Jerusalem and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once, he said, a man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. So he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas. Put this money to work, he said, until I come back. But his subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this man to be our king. He was made king, however, and returned home. Then he sent for the servants to whom he had given the money in order to find out what they had gained with it. The first one came and said, sir, your mina has earned 10 more. Well done, my good servant, his master replied. Because you have been trustworthy in very small matter, take charge of 10 cities.
The second came and said, "Sir, your mina has earned five more." His master answered, "You take charge of five cities." Then another servant came and said, "Sir, here's your mina. I've kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you, because you are a hard man. You take out what you did not put in and reap what you did not sow." His master replied, "I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, did you, that I am a hard man, taking out what I did not put in and reaping what I did not sow? Why then didn't you put my money on deposit, so that when I came back, I could have collected it with interest?" Then he said to those standing by, "Take his mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas. "Sir," they said, "he already has 10. He replied, "I tell you that to everyone who has more will be given. But as for the one who has nothing, even what they have will be taken away. But those enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me." This is not a happy, pretty little Care Bear story, is it? I see no unicorns in this story. Historically, it's been a difficult parable to interpret. You maybe recognize part of it because there's another version of it in Matthew's gospel. It's the parable of the talents. They're different sums of money. Likely, my belief is that records, Jesus often told stories in different ways. He's a master storyteller, so he may switch some of the ideas. He may switch some of the details of stories. So Luke told this version of it, and Matthew told another. That's my interpretation of what happened. But I do think that despite the difficulty of interpreting some of these parables, I think we all feel the weight of it when he shared it. It's like, I don't know exactly what you're saying, but it feels heavy, Jesus. And so I just want to make a couple observations about it and hopefully unpack some of the meaning. My first observation, kingdom values are hard to swallow. Kingdom values are hard to swallow. Right from the get-go, Luke tells us that the reason Jesus told this parable was to correct a misunderstanding. He had been talking about the kingdom of God. That's the big thing he'd been talking about in his preaching, his 3 years of ministry. Kingdom of God, kingdom of God. But for whatever reason, they took that and it meant for them that it's going to happen immediately. Hopefully in the form of Jesus leading a revolution to overthrow the Romans so that they're free now and can be Israel without any oppressive forces. Jesus instead had to deliver a hard truth. This would be nothing like they expected. So he delivered the truth in the form of a parable, which softens the blow a bit. It's kind of like taking a spoonful of sugar with your medicine. And Jesus is walking towards Jerusalem, Luke tells us, and the listeners have no idea, they have zero idea that he is walking a path towards crucifixion. He's walking a path towards death and resurrection. That's clueless. That's not on their minds. So he tells a story about a nobleman who goes to a faraway land to be installed as king. So it's not hard to see. Many commentators see this, that Jesus is clearly talking about himself. Man of noble birth. Son of God, son of man, all things he's been saying for a long time, shot in the dark, maybe he's talking about himself. Went away to a distant country. This is a reference to his path to the cross. The distant country is death. Appointed as king or kingly power. This is a resurrection from the dead. What better way to establish a man of noble birth's authority than conquering death? And then he will come back again. He will return, as both Paul and Peter would later say in the New Testament, Jesus will come back to judge the living and the dead. So that's the context that many of us just skate right over. We skate right over that, and we get right to the money. But even though the king bestows gifts on his servants, the citizens under his rule hate him. They don't want this man to be their king. Clearly, Jesus is referencing some of the people that he's coming into contact with, the religious rulers who he's constantly at loggerheads with. But this is wider than that. The citizens include everyone. Everyone in his kingdom. The people that are there listening to him teach. And all the people that would follow, including us. And I know that sounds kind of harsh, but let me just try to say it in a way, because I'm including myself in here too. How many of us balk, if we really think about it, at the idea of a king like Jesus who does things in the way he does them? I mean, really? Establishing your authority by dying? Do we know anyone who does that? Establish your authority by dying? That has nothing to do with our cultural values. Death is not how we understand power. Self-sacrifice is not how we understand justice or ethics. It's repugnant, even offensive to our ears. That's irresponsible. And just as a side note, how much change do you think the citizens and these people who are very unhappy made by telling the king, we don't want you to be king? That's like kind of like my children coming up to me and saying, Dad, I don't want you to be my dad. It's going to change the emotional climax, but it's not going to change biology, right? I'm going to always be their dad, and the king is always going to be their king. In many ways, this is a parable about reality, kind of how reality functions and how we fight against it. People are given gifts. There are different levels of production, and there's an ultimate authority who doesn't always do things the way that I want them done. So, second observation, kingdom values are easily misconstrued. Easily misconstrued. If you read some of the commentaries, listen to sermons about this particular parable, you will often hear the interpretation that this parable is hands down about production. Say the word production. So it's about production, that God holds us accountable for the levels of production that we make. How much are you going to do with what I've given you? How many of you have heard this position? Yeah, I grew up with this. I actually, for a long time, believe that, this is the proper interpretation of this parable. It just seemed to be clear. But the more I've dug into it, I think differently now about the interpretation. I think the interpretation of that production says more about our modern values than about kingdom values. If you study theology enough and read interpreters enough, you will find over time there is a pretty common theme of interpretation saying more about the interpreter than the text. Biases, presuppositions that we put into, and all of a sudden, our God looks a lot like us. Or as Anne Lamott says, if your God hates all the same people that you do, you're probably doing something wrong. Right? So let me give you an example of how things like this often get misconstrued. How many of you guys have heard of the 10,000-hour rule? You know, heard of it? It's shown up in pop culture all over the place. It was made popular by Malcolm Gladwell, who was actually relying on another study and research that was done in his book, Outliers. It's a really fascinating book. But this idea took America by storm. It's shown up in everything. And as it is interpreted, typically the way I hear it, the idea is that if someone engages deliberate practice for 10,000 hours of something, that makes them elite in that field of practice. Geniuses aren't born, right? They get there through effort and hard work. And let me tell you, America loves that message, right? Effort and hard work defines everyone. The only thing that separates you from me is how hard I work. Cue the eye roll, okay? That is not how that works. That is not how that works. Gladwell has actually come out to refute this interpretation, how everyone has taken it. He's like, firstly, he says, that rule doesn't apply to sports, so stop trying to do that. Secondly, he says that talent does matter. You can't just like take a bunch of people and have one person do 10,000 hours or something, and then all of a sudden they're the only expert. Because he said, for example, I could do 10,000 hours of playing chess and I'll never be a master. Talent does matter. Raw materials do matter, is what he's saying. But lastly, this is the most fascinating one to me. One of his main points in his book was that everyone who does 10,000 hours of something, the assumption is the only way they can do that is because they have a community of support around them to help them do that.
You can't just devote that many hours to something without the help of parents or spouses or family, friends, all of that. I mean, it's impossible. I'm not going to make a lot of money if I put $10,000 or 10,000 hours towards playing cello. How am I going to pay my mortgage? So I think it's interesting that what Gladwell meant for a lesson about some things we can control, some things we can't, and a lesson about the value of community support, we took and turned to a do-it-yourself pathway to ultimate success. Right? We turned it into that. And we got it wrong. And we do the same thing with this parable, I think. Here are my reasons, and once again, anyone can disagree with me, but I'm just trying to lay out why I've come to this, landed on this place. Here are my reasons why I think this isn't about production. Firstly, any of Jesus' teachings need to be put in the context of all of his teachings, right? All of his teachings. We can't just pick one and say it means this without really understanding the breadth of all he's taught. For example, the parable of the vineyard workers, which is all these people given different amounts of time to work. I don't know if you remember it, like someone shows up at the beginning of the day and they all kind of show up at different times. They all get different levels of effort, different levels of production, and all get paid the same thing at the end of the day. It's clearly a parable about grace. That production isn't tied to grace and his gifts and his generosity. So, for me, that kind of like X's out production from the beginning because that stands in direct contradiction of other teachings Jesus has made. But secondly, the king commands that the first two, commends the first two servants. If you remember, right, they produced, and then there's this third guy who put his gifts, wrapped them up in a napkin. He commends these and punishes this. What sets them apart? Production? No, not necessarily. That's not necessarily what sets them apart. I think it's unfortunate that in the parable we don't see like the example of someone who invested all of his money and then lost some of it. Because I think, personally, Jesus would have still commended their efforts. Because what Jesus, for me, was setting apart, the difference, was not their lack of production, but their lack of action. It wasn't a lack of production, it was a lack of action. You staying with me? And the last one, if this is enough evidence for you, if you look at verse 13, I'm going to try and say this in a way that doesn't get Greek nerdy, okay? I don't want to get Greek nerdy with you. The king says to put this money to work, and the word comes from this Greek word pragma, which is where we get the word pragmatic. It simply just means to do business. He says, here's these minas, go do business. Go do business. And then that word appears again in verse 15, where he comes back to see what business they've done. But if you'll notice, it often gets translated, what profit have you made? Those two words, the only time they appear in the New Testament. So the only way to really know what they truly mean is to look at surrounding Greek words at that time, and they never mean that. It demonstrates for me that even our biblical translators sometimes have biases we put into the translations. He comes back, he's just saying, what business did you do? And we insert profit, because we assume that's the point. Let me stop here. This is the real point of the parable, guys, and I think this is really important. Jesus is saying, live the life God gave you. Live the life God gave you. The man of noble birth comes back and he says, I didn't ask you to make money. I asked you to do business. Exercise a little trust that I meant you well. And I don't mind if you take some risks with the gift I gave you. Which leads me to the final value. Kingdom values point to trusting Jesus. If it's a kingdom value, it points me to trusting Jesus. If a value that I engage in encourages me to trust something above or beside Jesus, it's not a kingdom value. Consumerism tells me that my identity lies in things, My identity lies in possessions. Marketing encourages me to feel bad about my situation because I don't have X, Y, and Z, or compare myself to so-and-so and I'm not as good-looking or as successful as so-and-so. It's not a kingdom value, but that doesn't stop us from engaging in liturgies that lead us down that path. Now, some forms of patriotism, not all, encourage me to put my ultimate faith in the state or into my personal political ideologies. As if God's will cannot come to this planet unless my political ideologies are policy. God doesn't need all my great ideas about how the economy ought to work to get what he needs to get done. He doesn't need that. God's power is being thwarted by the people sitting on the other side of the aisle. No! He's still coming. Like the many generations of Christians before us, we often fall prey to practicing liturgies that put our hope not in Jesus, but in human systems. Empires, royalties, democracies. They're not bad. A lot of them are good. They're just not God. And they're not worthy of my ultimate trust. This parable ends rather harshly with the king punishing the wicked and the usurpers. But this is merely dramatic language, in my opinion, to reflect reality. Jesus is talking to a very kind of more barbaric culture than ours, and I don't think it would have offended any of their sensibilities, although it offends ours. For those who choose to reject the world, these are the people that didn't want him as king, God created, because they don't like the way he runs it, their lives are forfeit and folly. We live our lives fighting against reality. For the first servant who's given the wicked servant's money, we're like, that's not fair. He already has more than he knows what to do with. That is simply because this is a person who's lived their life trusting in Jesus' gifts to us and for us, like purposes for us. Just saying, we will live blessed lives. We will have more than we know what to do with. And that's not always resources, is it? You might have more energy than you know what to do with. You might have more compassion than you know what to do with. Your life might be overflowing with rich, meaningful relationships. You are blessed. That's what that means. The only thing this parable condemns is utter lack of trust. Fear drove the wicked servant to wrap his gift up into a napkin. Trust is the point. Action, doing business, living your life. That's what Jesus is looking for. Action. So on my sabbatical, I took a trip to Phoenix with Jeremy Tillman, who's sitting over here, but I'm not going to look at him. We played 86 holes of golf in 3 days. Say it with me. That's insane. That's insane. But we also, Jeremy wanted me to join him in one of his favorite hobbies, poker. Guys, he's really good at it. Like, that guy produces. You know what I mean? He's like the Rain Man. He's like, chicka-chicka-chicka-chicka, math kind of thing, you know? So we went to a casino and played, and that guy was just like, you know, chips are mine kind of thing. But he actually gave me some money to play. And by that, I mean he gave me $300. I would never spend it. I'd be like, after $2 in a slot machine, I'm like, I'm done. Guys, I was nervous because I'm like, he told me I could use that any way I wanted to. But I was like, what if I blow it? I'm not that great at poker. What if I just totally lose all of this money that he gave me so generously? And I thought, well, I guess I should just play. And I got pocket aces early on, which are my nemesis, because I think, well, what can beat this? And I start to see the flop, and I start going, well, I guess if I'm going to gamble, and I put some money in, and everyone starts folding, except for this one guy. He wouldn't fold. And he kept seeing and calling my bet and raising. I'm like, I kept looking at the cards, and I don't have the matrix in my brain about, like, poker. I'm like, I don't know. What am I not seeing? I'm not seeing something. He's got better cards than me, and I don't know what it is. And I keep, and before I know it, by the end, almost all of my chips are in there, and almost all his chips are in there. And I'm like, it's 30 minutes in. I'm about to blow all of it. We turn over the cards. We both have pocket aces. And both of us are like, oh, gosh. We just split the pot. It's like, okay, yeah, live to fight another day. And I am happy to say that after like 3 hours, I went up $45 and gave Jeremy back his $300. I was like, boom. Never doing that again. No, it was super fun. I think about it being with Jeremy, though. No matter what, I think if I would have lost it all, he would have been fine. The one thing I think that I could have done that would have really dishonored his generosity, not play. Not play. That's the one thing I could have done that would have upset his generosity, is not play. To take it into a napkin and say, you're a hard guy. And I didn't want to mess with it. Which would have been like me basically saying, I don't trust you. This is what God's kingdom is like. We have been given this gift. It's a once in a lifetime gift. Sure, it doesn't always look like the gifts of the person sitting next to you if we start comparing them all, but it's ours. It's our gift. It was given to us. And the king expects us to use it. To use it. His kingdom is a kingdom of action, of living and moving. And when it comes down to values, I want to close with the values of our faith community. Many of you have already heard these already. But that's the thing about values. They're not just something you can learn with your head. Repetition is important. How can we engage this? So as I go through this, I want to encourage you to think, what practice could I attach to this value? This is on our website. I'll just read through them. Number one, respect. Life in Deep Ellum honors the dignity of all people by respecting their unique backgrounds and beliefs and by creating intentional spaces that are welcoming and safe. How can I practice that respect? Authenticity. Life in Deep Ellum values the authentic, unique identities of all individuals and makes it a priority to model vulnerability and genuineness. How can I practice authenticity? Relationships. Life in Deep Ellum recognizes that whether they're planned or organic, relationships are the most important thing. They are at the center of all we do as a community. How can I incorporate a liturgy that builds relationships? Diversity. Life in Deep Ellum appreciates diversity. We celebrate and seek it out through our initiatives, partnerships, and faith community. What can I do, like a practice, to encourage diversity in my life so I'm not in an echo chamber all the time? Unity. Life in Deep Ellum cultivates unity around its mission to be the unexpected neighbor in the Deep Ellum community and with people of faith, with everyone. What can I practice? How can I practice that unity? And lastly, our word is creedal. Life in Deep Ellum is a creedal community, meaning we, when it comes down to our beliefs and doctrines, we point to the Apostles' Creed, and we let all those other arguments about all these secondary issues just kind of let them be. We intentionally focus on what we feel is the main thing, people genuinely connecting with God. For my money, these are the kinds of values that lead to the good life. It's who I want to be. So may you find ways to practice kingdom values. May they occur to you on your lunch break. When you're driving and going, I should call so-and-so.
Well, when we're in an argument with a family member or a spouse, the kingdom values. Don't fold up your gifts in a napkin. Use them. Take a risk. No one is a bigger risk taker than our God, who humbled himself down to a human and made himself weak and vulnerable. Trust that Jesus' plans and purposes are good. They're good plans and purposes for you. It's as G.K. Chesterton once said, it is when a man has found something which he prefers to life, that is to say, trusting Jesus rather than our idols, it is when a man has found something which he prefers to life, he then, for the first time, begins to live. So now to him who's able to keep you from falling, to present you for his glorious presence without fault and with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, be glory, power, majesty, and authority through Jesus Christ our Lord, now and forevermore, throughout all the ages. And we all say, I love you guys. Thank you.